Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A British Columbia court condones marriage discrimination, a novelist reveals skeletons in the American colonial closet, and two indie film hits treat touchy subjects. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending October 6th, 2001. A court in the Canadian province of British Columbia this week rejected a lawsuit seeking equal marriage rights for gay and lesbian couples. The constitutional challenge was brought by eight same-gender couples with the support of the national group EGAL, Equality for Gays and Lesbians Everywhere. Justice Ian Pitfield ruled that the sweeping impact of striking down the common law definition of marriage as between a man and a woman dictated that any such change should come through federal legislation rather than the courts. But he also declared that denying legal marriage to gay and lesbian couples is discriminatory, a statement believed to be the first of its kind by any Canadian court. However, he believes that discrimination is justified by marriage's role as an institution for child rearing. He wrote that the gain to society from the preservation of the deep-rooted and fundamental legal institution of opposite-sex marriage outweighs the detrimental effect of the law on the petitioners. The judge noted that gay and lesbian couples have already gained almost all the legal rights and responsibilities of married couples, thanks to a ruling by the Supreme Court of Canada and provincial legislation in BC. The plaintiff couples intend to take their case next to the BC Court of Appeals. Similar lawsuits are scheduled to be heard in November in Ontario and Quebec.
A U.S. federal appeals court last month upheld San Francisco's pioneering equal benefits ordinance. That significant legal victory for gay and lesbian couples was not widely reported because the ruling was delivered on the day of the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. In 1997, San Francisco became the first city in the U.S. to require its contractors to extend the same benefits to unmarried employees, registered domestic partners, that they offer their legally married employees' spouses. While hundreds of contractors complied with the law, the Air Transport Association challenged it on behalf of air carriers contracting for use of San Francisco International Airport. Previously, a federal trial court had found that federal laws regulating the airline industry took precedence over the city's law for purposes of so-called economic benefits, including health care and pensions. But the trial court had also found that the air carriers must comply with the city ordinance for so-called non-economic benefits, such as bereavement leave and spousal fare discounts. The airlines appealed that part of the ruling, hoping to avoid having to comply with disparate local ordinances in the various cities they serve. But the Ninth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals upheld it in a 2-to-1 ruling. Los Angeles and Seattle followed San Francisco in requiring city contractors to treat employees' domestic partners as spouses, and a similar measure was introduced this week in Atlanta, Georgia. Broward County, Florida gives preference points to bidders extending spousal health care benefits to employees' domestic partners.
Despite the federal appeal, almost every U.S. airline has by now extended full spousal benefits to its employees' same-gender partners, and they're hardly alone. The Human Rights Campaign reported this week that more than 700 U.S. employers extended spousal benefits to the partners of their gay and lesbian employees in the year ending August 2001. That brought the total to almost 4,300, including 145 of the Fortune 500 companies, with an increase for the year of 20%. From 1999 to 2001, the increase was 50%. One recent landmark was the New Orleans City Council's unanimous decision in September to extend domestic partner benefits to city workers.
But that doesn't mean the benefits are no longer controversial. Sedgwick County had announced last week that it was to become the first county in Kansas to extend them to its unmarried employees beginning October 1st. But this week, the county commission unanimously voted down the move by the county manager, citing numerous complaints from residents.
Two U.S. cities have joined the ranks of those prohibiting discrimination based on sexual orientation. Last week, the Bangor, Maine City Council voted 8-1 to prohibit sexual orientation discrimination in housing, employment, education, credit, and public accommodations. Those who feel they've experienced discrimination are empowered to file civil lawsuits. Religious groups are exempt. This week, the Normal, Illinois City Council voted 5-2 before a capacity crowd to add sexual orientation as a protected category under the city's human relations ordinance. The ordinance prohibits discrimination in housing and employment, with an exemption for religious organizations in the course of carrying out or furthering their religious activities. Those who feel they've experienced discrimination can complain to the city's Human Relations Commission.
But the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon are significantly impacting the progress of gay and lesbian civil rights in the U.S. After years of observing National Coming Out Day on October 11th, the National Human Rights Campaign has canceled any national event because the date marks the one-month anniversary of the attacks. Instead, individuals are encouraged to honor and assist those gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender Americans who have been affected by the terrorist attacks. And on Capitol Hill, gay-supportive U.S. Senator Ted Kennedy canceled a hearing scheduled for this week on the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, or ENDA. Kennedy said that both ENDA and a measure to empower the federal government to prosecute anti-gay hate crimes have been shelved until next year. The move is hardly unique. The federal government has postponed almost all domestic issues not relating to anti-terrorism and relief efforts.
The U.S. Navy this week followed the Air Force in temporarily suspending most administrative discharges, but not those relating to the so-called Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy on gay and lesbian service members. The so-called stop-loss policy is intended to maximize the number of personnel available for combat. The specific exclusion of so-called gay discharges from the Navy and Air Force policies differs from all the stop-loss policies issued from late World War II through the Gulf War.
The Bush administration's appointment of open gay Michael Guest to serve as ambassador to Romania has ignited considerable debate there. Two conservative Romanian nationalist groups, the Cradle of Romania Party and the League for Combating Anti-Romanian Manifestations, wrote to Washington and to the Romanian press expressing disgust at the appointment and calling it an affront to Romanian traditions. But Romania's Ministry of Foreign Affairs responded this week with a statement that intolerance and questioning someone's private life are not at all characteristics of the Romanian people and are against the values of democracy, human rights, and individual freedom. The Romanian ambassador to the U.S., Soren Ducaru, called Guest a highly respected diplomat, affirmed that his government had been aware of Guest's orientation well before his confirmation, but had not viewed it as an issue, and had issued visas to both Guest and his partner, Alex Navarez. Romania's national leadership has been struggling for years against homophobic nationalist sentiment to bring its laws up to the European Union's standard of equal treatment for gays and lesbians.
The Council of Europe's executive body has issued a statement in support of gay and lesbian civil rights for the first time in the half-century since the Council's founding. The Committee of Ministers, composed of the foreign ministers of 43 nations, said in a statement that homosexuality can still give rise to powerful cultural reactions in some societies or sectors thereof, but this is not a valid reason for governments to remain passive. On the contrary, this fact only underlines the need to promote greater tolerance in matters of sexual orientation. Leaders of ILGA, the International Lesbian and Gay Association, called it a strong statement, given the number and diversity of countries involved, and noted that never before have so many governments joined in attacking homophobia.
And this week, the annual Conference of Europe's Liberal Parties, ELDR, unanimously adopted a resolution calling for equal marriage rights for gay and lesbian couples. The resolution was proposed by the Netherlands D66 party and included an amendment by Belgium's VLD party explicitly calling for equal parental rights.
New Zealand's Georgina Beyer, the world's first openly transsexual member of parliament and previously the world's first transsexual mayor, has decided to stay in politics after all. In April, she'd said she would not run for re-election when her current term in parliament ended. But the leaders of her Labour Party worked hard to convince her to continue, particularly since she represents a traditionally conservative rural district. Beyer said, "It's a woman's right to change her mind, isn't it?"
And finally, Korean trans woman Ha Ri-soo made a triumphant homecoming to the all-male high school she graduated from 6 years ago. Earlier this year, Ha, a model, actress, and singer, became the first transsexual ever to appear in a commercial on Korean TV and brought the nation's dialogue on gender issues to a new level. The students of her alma mater, Naksing High School in Seongnam, voted her the public figure they most wanted to meet. They cheered as she sang at the school's annual festival, moving Ha so deeply that she contributed 10 million won to the school's scholarship fund.
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 6th, 2001. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
The unusual characters you'll meet on this week's program include two who helped George Washington win the U.S. War for Independence, a cross-dressing patriot and fey revolutionary, and two teens on the wrong side of the law and two older men whose motives may be questionable. But first, more news. Some familiar foes of lesbian and gay rights have been highly visible in the weeks since the terrorist attacks on New York City and Washington, D.C., but to what effect? This Way Out's Lucia Chappell reports on the latest homophobic twist in the aftermath of the tragedy.
Religious right campaigner Luce Sheldon of the Traditional Values Coalition got his moment in the post-September 11th media spotlight this week by calling on terrorist attack relief agencies to deny assistance to the surviving members of lesbian and gay relationships. In a prepared statement, coalition spokesperson Steve Aiken said,
"We do not believe that this is a proper time for homosexual activists to attempt to push their agenda to redefine what a traditional marriage is. No surviving parent, child, or family member should be denied benefits in accordance with law or policy."
But the Reverend Elder Troy Perry of the Universal Fellowship of Metropolitan Community Churches says that the tragic events require looking beyond simple legality.
"I believe that love defines family, nothing more, nothing less. Just because at this time the law says I can't marry legally in this country, it doesn't mean that my relationship isn't as real as anyone else's. We have one member of our church in New York City who is burned over 40% of her body, is in a coma, is not expected to live, and certainly her spouse and her son certainly deserve to be helped during this crisis."
Still, the Traditional Values Coalition insists,
"This is not the time to attempt to establish new marital benefits for homosexual partnerships. Those that are trying to promote this are involved in a very cynical manipulation of a great tragedy."
The coalition's attack on aid for gay and lesbian victims' families came days after it announced its intention to take part in a campaign to repeal Maryland's new law banning discrimination based on sexual orientation. It's the third wave of headline-grabbing anti-gay rhetoric since September 11th. The first wave was led by Reverend Jerry Falwell.
"I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them, I point the finger in their face and say, you helped this happen."
No sooner than Falwell had retracted those remarks, conservative groups such as Concerned Women for America and the Family Research Council launched the second wave with complaints that pro-lesbian and gay legislation was being moved behind the scenes while the nation was in mourning. However, their PR storm appears to have been a false alarm, since anti-terrorism-related measures have now taken precedence over everything. Several national gay and lesbian organizations have indicated that they understand the situation. They are joining with other civil liberties groups who have called on Congress to be cautious in guarding constitutional protections as they respond to terrorism. For This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell.
Still to come this week, a novel approach to American history with revolutionary scoundrel Paul Lussier. And one film's been called unsettling and creepy. The other's been described as Death in Venice with a higher body count. Our Steve Pride has previews.
Hi, I'm Amanda Burst, Marcy Darcy from Married with Children, and you're listening to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. Stay tuned.
There is something very insidious in portraying the history of the War for Independence as a parade of the Founding Fathers. It seems very patriotic, but we shut out the voice of minorities. You shut out the voice of the 18th century version of gays and lesbians. The novel is no less a fiction than our traditional historical narrative is.
You say you want a revolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world.
As we discovered last week, Paul Lussier has put the revolution back into the American Revolution with his well-received historical novel, Last Refuge of Scoundrels. He told This Way Out's Rita Gonzalez about his nearly 10 years of research into the period and how he found that the diaries of everyday participants in the U.S. War for Independence put a whole new spin on the spirit of 76. According to Lussier, most of the iconic U.S. founding fathers were a self-interested gentry in contempt of the common people, with the one exception being General and soon-to-be first U.S. President George Washington.
In order to win this war, George Washington was forced to live cheek by jowl, elbow to elbow with the tapestry of America, people from all diverse walks of life that he not only had to support and work with and cooperate with, he saw fit to embrace. He not only was indulgent of cross-dressers, etc., he embraced them. And so George Washington, embracing these people, ushered our way to independence, and these people formed a critical, pivotal role. And among those people, of course, my two lead characters, John and Deborah.
In the conclusion of this two-part feature interview with author Paul Lussier, we learned that one of George Washington's most successful envoys to France was a self-described fey man, and that one of his most trusted strategists was a cross-dressing female soldier.
Tell us about the basis for the character Deborah Simpson.
Deborah Simpson is a composite of three women. Deborah Sampson, who fought as a male soldier under the name of Robert Shurtleff, saw action at Yorktown, and when news got out at the end of the war that there had been many such women dressed as men, George Washington dishonorably discharged her. But look at this. She, angered, took to the road and in a precursor to vaudeville, dressed as a man, told the world, the colonies, of her stories of the American Revolution. And it wasn't until about a decade ago that we began to realize and accept the fact that her stories were true. She's a composite of this woman, who, by the way, did get her military pension later on in life because Paul Revere, at the behest of, again, George Washington, after discharging her, George Washington snuck back into her life and earned her her military pension. And although she was never, ever seen dressed as a woman again, she was a decorated military hero and the first of our country. So my character, Deborah Simpson, is a composite of Deborah Sampson, who I just described, and two chief spies of George Washington. They both only had numbers, not names. One was 333.33, which represents the first expenditure Washington made in Cambridge, which we now know went to a female cross-dressing spy. And the other was another woman, 693.26, not a cross-dresser, but a master of disguise of all kinds, who languished and died on the Jersey prison ship. These three women form Deborah Simpson, and all of the cloak and dagger machinations, all of the clever ruses and disguises that she avails herself of in the book are true. I did not make one of those. I couldn't be that clever. They are true.
Well, I did look him up.
Oh, there you see, yes. And her partner in crime is John Lawrence, who is, again, is not a composite. The only liberty I take with John Lawrence, Rita, is I bring him to the war earlier than he actually was in real life. He didn't come until 1777, but I have him in 1775. He was an aide of George Washington's who hated the sound of gunfire, was, of his own admission, a fey man, was a very gentle spirit and gentle soul. George Washington saw fit at the end of the war, as you saw in the book, to actually send John Lawrence, this fey androgynous man, to France to appeal to the king for arms, which Congress had been loath to provide and Benjamin Franklin was not able to provide. And he sent this 28-year-old, and I don't use the word in the book, obviously, because it's steeped in 18th century idiom, but a queer, to France to appeal to the king. And as a result of that audience, John Lawrence came back to the colonies with a ship laden with gold and cannon, without which our victory at Yorktown wouldn't have been possible. And that is not a fact, by the way, that any historian disputes. And furthermore, John Lawrence was given a porcelain snuffbox by the king upon which is written, "Long live the American Revolution." Now, where is that little porcelain snuffbox? It's in the Smithsonian under jewelry. And you can bet if that was given to one of our apotheosized founding fathers or a man that history was more comfortable with because he more conformed to a military hero, that would not be in a marginalized cabinet of jewelry in the Smithsonian. It would be a cultural relic.
Now, at the end of the book, you state that the war is over, but not the revolution. What did you mean by that?
What I mean is that the revolution is now. And what I mean by that is even the common man who lived at the time when we won at Yorktown, there were riots all up and down the eastern seaboard for fear that the revolution would not be won, that we would be content with having earned independence from England, and that we would go back to a state of civil strife, inequality, and no commitment to emancipation. So that struggle lives on. And the spirit of those revolutionaries who were disappointed in Yorktown and feared that we would fall back into sort of an aristocratic, British, hierarchical, exclusive, elitist bias culture, their suspicions have been borne out. And so in their honor, we fight on. And in their honor, the spirit of the American Revolution must live on.
I love the book.
Thank you.
Why do you think this novel is particularly appropriate for a gay audience?
Well, first of all, I think there's been no question that what this is a story of is how this country owes a huge debt for its freedom to two characters who represent, include, and embody queer spirit. And ultimately, when you see the way George Washington embraced these folks of queer spirit, when you see how critical their perspective was in the struggle for independence, and when you see how triumphant we were as a result of their contribution, there's simply no question that gays can look to the core mythology that defines patriotism in our culture and say, guess what? I belong, and I will not be marginalized any longer, because the history, the story clearly shows that I was there, and you owe me that recognition.
That was author Paul Lussier in conversation with This Way Out's Rita Gonzalez. Last Refuge of Scoundrels from Warner Books is available at most bookstores and online. Two movies that have stirred controversy at gay and lesbian film festivals across North America may finally be making their way to theaters around the U.S. This Way Out's Steve Pride chats with LIE director Michael Cuesta and Oscar-nominated Our Lady of the Assassins director Barbet Schroeder about their respective films.
For most moviegoers, the fall season means putting the high concept and car chase films behind us and partaking of more intelligent cinematic fare. Coincidentally, two of the most complex and controversial new releases aimed at gay audiences are both about teenage boys in complicated relationships with much older men.
Hi, I'm Michael Cuesta, and my film is LIE, also known as Long Island Expressway. The film is about a boy, Howie. In a space of about a single week, he goes through a series of losses, his mother, father, and his best friend. My intent was to not say he's gay or straight, but just to depict a 15-year-old kid exploring it. Love comes in many ways, many faces. I mean, I think truly that's what the film was about at its core, the need for that and how it's found and where it's found.
While Howie may be confused about his feelings for his best friend Gary, a troubled kid who secretly hustles at an LIE rest stop, it's Howie's naive relationship with a 50-something father figure named Big John that earned the film controversy and its NC-17 rating.
I didn't go in. There's not one mention of the word pedophile in the film. That's something that has been labeled since the film's creation and that's since it's been put out there.
How old are you, Howie?
I'm 16.
Oh? When are you 16?
July 8th.
How tall are you? How much do you weigh?
I don't know, 120 pounds. Well, how do you want?
You doing all this for your friend Gary?
Yeah.
What do you know about Gary Howard?
He's a good friend and a cool guy. That's all I need to know.
What do you know about me?
Nothing.
Do you want to know something about me?
No offense, but not really.
Gary's clearly a hustler. So Gary's obviously involved, and Gary knows where he stands with Big Johnny. Sex for money, you know, stuff like that. So it's more consensual, you know, where Howie's obviously an innocent to someone like Big John, as they say, a chicken hawk, and he's prey.
While Michael Cuesta's film LIE is an exercise in subtlety and nuance, Our Lady of the Assassins is not so shy. It's also the first Spanish-language film from the Oscar-nominated director of Reversal of Fortune, Barfly, and Single White Female.
Hello, I'm Barbet Schroeder, director of La Virgen de los Sicarios, Our Lady of the Assassins. It's a love story in the country of hate.
adapted from Fernando Vallejo's 1994 novel, Our Lady of the Assassins tells the story of a writer in his late 50s who has grown tired of living, but who comes alive when introduced to a 16-year-old assassin named Alex.
I don't know exactly how autobiographical it is, but definitely some of the characters that are depicted in the book exist. I've met them, so I know it's partly true. And actually, I went to see the character who introduced the real young boy to the writer, and I enlisted him as a help for casting. And he's the one who indicated me the lead actor. He's the one that spotted him for me, and I went looking for him for months because I couldn't find him. But he was spotted first by this man who gave a young boy as a present to the writer. That's how the movie starts.
16-year-old Alex is an indiscriminate assassin, shooting rude cab drivers as quickly as rival gang members. Yet Fernando stands by him.
That's how this boy sees life. That's the world that he's living in. And the main character learns to discover that reality. This is the biggest love story of his life. This is one of the most important events in his love life. And he's faced, this writer, is faced with the choice of not seeing this boy anymore, because this boy is a killer and he can't be really stopped, or trying to control him by staying next to him. And obviously, you know, he chooses the second option because his love is too important.
This is a violent film made more frightening by its documentary feel. Schroeder shot on high-definition video on location in Medellin, Colombia, with a largely non-professional cast.
Those boys are from the poor neighborhoods of Medellin, and they are from that background, that culture. They're not killers. I met a lot of young professional killers, and they're exactly the same. And they're very charming, and they're very innocent, and you know they're not going to live long. But I couldn't really work with them as a director. Something was stopping me. Anyway, the real ones that I met were not good-looking enough.
Earlier this year, Barbe Schroeder won awards at both the Havana and Venice Film Festivals for Our Lady of the Assassins. Michael Cuesta won the New Directors Award for LIE at this year's Edinburgh International Film Festival. The film also won Outstanding American Narrative Feature at Outfest, LA's Gay and Lesbian Film Festival, and was nominated for the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance. Both films are coming soon to a theater near you. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for tuning into This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Christopher Gall, Graham Underhill, Chris Ambage, Brian Nunes, Jason Lynn, Rex Walkner, Rita Gonzalez, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Thanks also to Chris Allen and to Aaron Glantz and Nell Abram of Free Speech Radio News. The Beatles sang Revolution, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. Just point your browser to www.planetout.com and click first on Multimedia, then on Radio. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded through direct charitable donations from our listeners around the world. For an urgent message about This Way Out's perilous financial situation, please visit our webpage at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on MBS Radio Amsterdam, the Netherlands, KUBO El Centro, California, WRVU Nashville, Tennessee, and more than 125 other stations around the world, including this local community radio station. Do stay tuned.